as you just saw in the last play, with an uncontrolled mind, there's no possibility of happiness. This secret is what is beyond the understanding of our current society. People are working hard, studying hard, all for the point of happiness. But because their minds are out of control, they'll never experience what is happiness. Just like the evil genie always has something to do. Always, the evil genie always has to have something to do. Similarly, the mind non-stop is tossing about this way and that way. And just to get relief from your aching mind, you try so many hobbies, so many attempts at pleasure, all because your mind is so restless. You do something, and then you consider changing it. Maybe I'll change my course of study, change my job. Later, when you're more established in life, you think, I'll change my car, even I'll change my wife, or change. All because the mind is unsteady. If you can learn to control your mind, then you have a chance for happiness. But without understanding the secrets of mental peace, even if you are the wealthiest person in the world, you'll not be happy. Those of you who are here for our retreat in July, remember I explained to you the situation of the, now he's the third wealthiest person in the world, Oracle software. He presents himself as being so happy. He says, I am worth $13 billion. I can have whatever I want. I heartily recommend this to everyone. I can have airplanes. Why airplanes? I can have a whole airport. Why a yacht? I can have a whole harbor. I am a very happy man. I am worth $13 billion. Now you would like nod your head, yeah, I was worth even $1 million. What to think of? $13 billion. I would be happy too. Are you sure? This number three wealthiest man is very lonely. He gets his pride and self-esteem just by ostentatious, flashy demonstrations of wealth. The house he lives in is perfectly designed as a medieval Chinese mansion, down to the detail. He has whatever he wants. Do you really think he's as happy as he says he is? I'm a very happy man. I'm worth $13 billion. He's always trying to get you to remember that point. I'm worth $13 billion. I hardly recommend this to everyone. How do you know he's lying when he says he's happy? As soon as he hears about the number two wealthy man, the Microsoft man, he becomes very angry. Why are they always talking about him? What about me? I'm successful too. Why does he get all the attention? What about me and what I've done? Single-handedly. Almost. He gets very angry. Very envious. That shows you he's not happy. Now you would say that if you had $13 billion, you wouldn't be envious, right? You'd be satisfied with what you have. Right? Mm-hmm. But the material nature does not work like that. You cannot take shelter of material nature and expect peace, whether you have $5 or $13 billion. Because it is the nature of the material energy to always create dissatisfaction in you. You never have enough. So don't think, all I need is X amount of dollars and then I can rest in peace, I'll be tranquil. No, this is a great illusion. The illusory energy of Lord Krishna does not work like that. That is why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Daivi Esha Gunamayi Mamamaya Durakjaya. Krishna tells you himself. He doesn't hide anything. In Bhagavad Gita, he reveals everything clearly. This material energy of mine is almost impossible to overcome. There's only one way you can beat it, and that is if you get my personal help. Otherwise, you can't. So, you may think, if I had $13 billion, I would be so satisfied. I would be giving charity. I would take care of all my relatives and all the friends of my relatives. I would go back to my village. I would build a big hospital there. I would, so many things I would do. And I wouldn't want anything more. Right? You think like that? It will not happen. As soon as you grab hold of the tail of material happiness, you're dragged here and there. It never stops. You can't have peace. You must always want more and more, and you must always fight problem after problem. There's no such thing as stable material happiness in this world. Especially because the mind is uncontrolled. Without a peaceful mind, there's no possibility of happiness. If you are a poor person, but you have a peaceful mind, you'll be happy. Maybe many of you have actually gone to remote villages in India, and it's shocking, but the people look happier than any you'll find in Melbourne or Sydney. I have done this. I've gone to remote villages in Bengal near the Bangladesh border, and I have seen people at ease and happy, having practically nothing. And then I have seen the wealthiest persons in this world who have everything except peace. You cannot buy a peaceful mind. Do you understand that? No store sells it. That is why all your efforts to be happy through increased status, increased social status, increased financial power, these efforts will never work because what you need, you can't buy. And as soon as you understand that, you'll be able to transform your whole life. What you need, you can't buy. You need mental peace, freedom from anxiety. Now, the transcendental process of Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga, easily gives you peace because all the activities of bhakti yoga are for the pleasure of Lord Krishna. In other words, you become truly happy by selfless service. But who do you selflessly serve? You cannot get that flavor of peace you're searching for by trying to selflessly serve temporary things, temporary persons. In order for there to be true peace in your mind, you must serve the Supreme Eternal. You see, even if you try to serve selflessly other persons, your family, your nation, all humanity, still you won't be peaceful because they are not the legitimate objects of your service. They cannot benefit you with the fullness of flavor that you want. But if you connect that serving propensity to Krishna, the source of everything, Krishna has the unlimited ability to give you the flavors you need in your life to satisfy you. Devotional service to Lord Krishna nourishes you. Try to understand what the problem is. When you try to serve persons who are limited, you get a limited result. Therefore, you can't be peaceful in your mind. When you try to serve temporary persons in this world, or temporary organizations, temporary nations, temporary families, you only get a dim reflection of real happiness. There's something there, but it's so insubstantial, it practically tortures you. You think you have it, but then you don't. But when you are trained to understand that the temporary and insubstantial reciprocation with your service that you get in this world, all is a shadow of the real happiness and satisfaction you get by service to Krishna, then your mind can be peaceful. The whole point of bhakti yoga is to put Krishna in the center of all your service activities. Now, bhakti yoga doesn't mean you give up your family, or you don't have a family, or give up your job, give up your studies. No, it means to put Krishna firmly in the center of all your activities. This is the great art of work. How to do activity in this world without reaction. Karma-free work. Only then will your mind be peaceful. You see, a stressed out mind, a mind full of anxiety, is an indication from material nature that you're endeavoring in the wrong way. It's not by chance that your mind becomes stressed and anxiety-ridden when you perform material activities. Just like if you go outside without a jacket and it's a cold day, you'll start to develop the symptoms of a cold or the flu. Similarly, if you engage in activities, karmic activities, meaning you don't sacrifice the results for Krishna, then the symptoms of your disease will manifest as stress and anxiety. That's just one of the symptoms of reactions you're getting. So stress and anxiety teach you something. Just like when you have the symptoms of a cold, it's teaching you something. You know, you have to do something when you get the symptoms of a cold. Drink some herbal tea, take some echinacea or some Ayurvedic herbs or something. Similarly, when you notice your mind overwhelmed by stress and anxiety, it means you have to make an adjustment. The stress and anxiety is nature's way of teaching you that your life is not in balance. How do you balance your life? It's not simply by adding some relaxation time to your work or study schedule. That's not going to balance your life. Balancing your life doesn't mean to have a few quiet moments every day. The true balance of your life means to have a sufficient blend of selfless service to Krishna mixed in with your daily activities. Of course, the more that your life becomes characterized by selfless service to Krishna, the more successful your life is, the more wealthy you truly are. Therefore, a smart person is always trying to increase the percentage of selfless activities for Krishna in his or her life. This is a wonderful occupation. This is actually our main goal in life. How to look at our life and manage it in such a way that the percentage of selfless service for Krishna is always increasing, somehow or other. That doesn't mean you discard your family or your work or your studies, but it means the whole purpose of your family, your work, and your studies is to contribute to your selfless service to Krishna. There is where the mental peace is. When you serve without wanting anything for yourself. Now it is true that throughout the world, some people are understanding that hedonism doesn't give a peaceful mind. Self-centeredness doesn't give a peaceful mind. Well, some people in this world are looking for opportunities. How can I do something for someone without getting any return? It's good for you to think like that. But with knowledge, you have to find the suitable person to serve without expecting anything in return. The whole point of Bhagavad Gita is to show you that Krishna is the object of your selfless service. Because Krishna is the self of the self. You cannot find anyone more close to you than Krishna. You are his part. And it is the nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth, the complete whole, to be present in each of his parts. Because there is nothing more close to you than Krishna. Because he is the self of yourself. Therefore, Krishna is the perfect object for your selfless service. Maybe some of you have tried selfless service to some temporary, limited entity in this world. Whomever you've tried to serve, you'll notice you were not fully satisfied and your mind was not fully peaceful because that limited temporary person is not able to reciprocate with you in such a way that your mind automatically and naturally is peaceful. Maybe you've tried all the different types of seva, all the different types of service. Family seva, nation seva, community seva, university seva, corporation seva. Maybe you've tried it all. I'm going to really do this. I'm going to really sacrifice myself for this cause. And you notice, still your mind is not peaceful. Therefore, the Bhagavad Gita directs you to learn how to serve Krishna selflessly. Because Krishna is the self of yourself. Just like Arjuna fought in a battle, the battle of Kurukshetra. But he fought selflessly. He did not fight to please himself. He fought to please Krishna. So we should also do like that. You don't have to run away from the world. Krishna consciousness doesn't mean to run away from the world. Bhakti yoga doesn't mean you turn your back on the world. It means you transform the world through selfless service to Krishna. Let's explain that more. You see, usually when it comes to a spiritual approach to the world, there are two conceptions. One is the otherworldly conception. Forget this world, just keep your eyes on the spiritual world. This world that we're in now is just a training place for the spiritual world. And so don't take anything in this world seriously. Just bide your time. And if you lead a good life, then at the end, you'll go to the other world. That's one way of looking at things. The other world conception. And then, the opposite conception is the this world conception. This world is all that there is. Don't try to stare off into space thinking there's another world. Put all your energies into this world. Political emancipation, economic development, here and now. And such persons who are attached to this conception, they resent any energy directed towards an otherworldly goal. They think it's dehumanizing. It's causing people to neglect developing the potential of where they are now, instead of trying to improve this earth and how we live. They're dreaming of the other world. So these two extremes are always there. Not simply Marx said the other world religions are the opiate of the people, but many persons who are into ecology, political agitation, they resent anything that puts the people's attention on the other world. They want all attention focused on the here and now. And that way they think there'll be maximum productivity. The other side, the otherworldly people, say, why bother with this world? It's just here and gone. Just focus on the world beyond. Now you may wonder, which one is bhakti yoga, as Lord Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita? Which one is Krishna consciousness? The answer is neither. Bhakti yoga is the perfect synthesis of this world and the other world. We don't deny that there is another world. Krishna says that plainly in Bhagavad Gita. Parastasmat tu bhavanyo vyakta vyakta sanatana. There is another world, Krishna says, and it's superior to this world. What is its nature, this other world? When everything in this world is annihilated, all in the other world remains as it is eternal. So Krishna does say in the Gita, there is another world. So we don't deny that, of course. But then there's also this world, too. And Krishna talks about that in Bhagavad Gita. He doesn't deny this world. Bhumirapo nilo vayu kangmano bhuja evacha. Krishna talks about the material energy. Biname prakriti astada. The material energy is mine, Krishna says. So there you have both worlds in Bhagavad Gita. The other world, the spiritual world, and this world, the material world. Both belong to Krishna. In the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Aham sarvasya prabhavo mata sarvam pravartate. I am the origin of everything material and spiritual. In other words, Krishna is saying, the other world comes from me. This world comes from me. Iti matta bhajante ma buddha bhava samanvita. When you understand this, then you are truly learned, you're truly wise, and you engage in selfless service to Krishna with transcendental ecstasy. Bhakti yoga is the perfect synthesis of this world and the other world. How to use this world in the best proper way, and how to go to the other world in the quickest amount of time. That is bhakti yoga. It does this easily Because Bhakti Yoga recognizes that all the energy belongs to Krishna, whether it's material or spiritual. So whether you're in this world or the other world, if you are properly connected to Krishna through selfless service, then you have everything. You don't even worry about a peaceful mind. As long as you have selfless service to Krishna, mental peace follows, tags along so easily. Now, let's look deeper at this point, because I know that some of you have experienced the idea of doing something simply for someone else. Community service, national service, family service. These entities, community, family, nation, they're limited. They're temporary. They cannot reward you with the mental peace you require, because they're temporary material entities. But you apply that selfless service to Krishna, and you'll always be rewarded more than you expect, because Krishna is the only legitimate object of service. By serving Krishna, does that mean you neglect your family, neglect your studies, neglect your job? No. But your family affairs, your work affairs, your study affairs are all spiritualized, because you're daily making the connection to Krishna's service with everything you have. You're using your skills that you learn in school for how to do something for Krishna in this world. You're using the money you earn from your work for how to finance efforts to teach others how to be Krishna conscious. Your family becomes a temple, and the temple staff are your family members. You keep them connected to Krishna's service. So in this way, your whole life becomes spiritualized in Krishna consciousness, even though you're living in this world. So the devotee of Lord Krishna, the bhakti yogi, doesn't get caught up in this polarity, this duality. This world, the other world, which one am I for? Should I just live in this world and pay it no attention and just be ready to transfer myself to the other world? Or do I just live in this world and forget all about any other world and take this world to be the everything? Bhakti yoga means both this world and the other world. That is how Krishna presents things in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna teaches you how to transfer yourself to the other world and also how to live in this world. So often you'll hear people become harassed by these two polarities. Should we endeavor in this world, or should we forget about this world? Should we simply focus on the other world, or is that ignoring our human potential? Do you want to understand what is your real potential? What is your real capacity? It is for selfless service. Doing something without any expectation of a reward. That is the most powerful activity. For material purposes, people glorify others who have done what appears to be selfless service. National heroes, welfare work heroes. This person built the hospital. This person is feeding the poor. This person gave his life for the country. I've explained to you before how every American school child is taught to revere one national hero during the war to of independence with England. This person became a spy, and he was spying on the British for the sake of the colonists, the future states. So he was captured by the British, and they were about to hang him. And they asked him, this is 200 and almost 250 years ago or something, still every American school kid is taught this mantra. The British asked him, we're going to hang you. Do you have any last words to say as the noose tightens around your neck? And what did he say? I only regret that I have just one life to give for my country. Every school kid is taught that. This is the nectar. This is where the taste is. When I was on the airplane, before they had the individual movie screens for every seat, they had the big screen in the front, and so you have to really work hard to ignore the screen. So when I was walking in, finding my seat, they were showing when, this is some years ago, they were showing an Indian movie, and in it was a general who was, the army general, who was declaring his allegiance, and he was saying very dramatically, the love of my country flows in me thicker than my blood. So, this kind of declaration, it attracts people. Even though they might not want to live like that, still sounds attractive. Oh, what a hero. Oh, I wouldn't do that, but how sacrificial, how selfless. There's something attractive about it. Actually, it seems attractive because it is a perverted reflection of one of the unlimited opulences of Krishna, renunciation. Krishna has not only unlimited wealth, unlimited beauty, unlimited knowledge, unlimited fame, and unlimited strength, but Krishna also has unlimited renunciation, detachment. So that is why selflessness has this even a shadow of attractiveness in this world. When the selflessness is for temporary things like nation, family, community. It's a reflection of real selfless activity for the pleasure of Bhagavan Krishna. Let's talk about happiness. We've approached it from the angle of the mind. Whether the mind is controlled or not will determine your happiness. Not your level of income, not your job position, but whether your mind is peaceful. Now, we spoke this morning about how there was some dismay, some disgruntlement, when some years ago the UN Human Development Report put India as 124th among 172 countries that were rated. And the Minister for Human Resources at that time was Murali Manohar Joshi. Any of you related to him? He's probably out of office now because of the change in government. So, he said, how could this be? How could India be 124th amongst 172 countries? Just 12 countries ahead of Pakistan. And even Sri Lanka is ahead at 89, number 89. How could this be? This UN research did not take into account India's spiritual wealth. So the report was focusing on social development issues, and it didn't like that, according to the report, there are 100... $1 million missing women in the world, and half of them are in India missing. And that, according to their survey, there are 10,000 cases of female infanticide a year in India. So the report, the UN was disturbed by this, so they really knocked India back some notches because of this, while praising some things. So, the government was disturbed that you're not taking into account so many factors. What are the factors for true happiness? Let's look at a country like Bhutan. Tiny place. Has no significance for the rest of the world. But according to those who are trying to understand what are the problems today, Bhutan... It's very interesting for them. First of all its scholarship students who are studying abroad almost always come back. Now, of course, you know that doesn't happen. Rarely do they come back. So why is it that in Bhutan, the graduate students, when they finish their scholarship studies at Cambridge, Oxford, they still come back just for a $120 a month job in Bhutan. They all say, our mind is more peaceful, we're happier in Bhutan. And this is so, even though Bhutan is supposedly one of the poorest countries in the world. Well, some years ago, the government threw out the usual economic indicators for development and prosperity, especially gross national product, GNP, and the government, led by the king there, made a new standard called GNH, gross national happiness. And people in the world began to take note that it's interesting. A whole nation dedicated not to feverish economic prosperity, but to happiness. So, the way that this tiny country, 850,000 people in Bhutan, the way they sought to measure their happiness or develop their happiness is through what they call the four pillars of happiness. Sustainable economic development, conservation of the environment, promotion of national culture, and good government, good democratic government. So, in this way, they're trying how to focus on the people's satisfaction rather than focusing directly on economic development. Now, we applaud this kind of attempt, but we also know it's missing the mark. Because unless you target spiritual development directly, you will not get the desired result of satisfaction and peace that you want. Spiritual development means connecting the soul to the Supreme Soul through selfless service. That is Bhakti Yoga. Such selfless spiritual service, Krishna consciousness, is far beyond community seva, nation seva, family seva. It's far beyond taking care of the environment. If the people of Bhutan would combine the spiritual goals of Bhagavad Gita with their material attempts to have a balanced society, then you would see wonders. Still, from the material point of view, it's a very interesting example. And it's causing people to think that economic growth cannot satisfy the heart. Therefore, governments should be promoting personal growth. So there's always the problem, though. Well, what do you do about the economy? You can't just make economic endeavors go away. You can't forget about them. But now we're learning that economic endeavors don't make people happy. As we said this morning, since World War II, the gross national products of developed nations have skyrocketed, but the level of happiness of the people, according to how scientists measure it, has remained the same or deteriorated. So it shows you a lot of endeavor is not producing satisfaction or happiness. Bhutan is a good example to show that. By world standards, they're poor. Yet, because they're more satisfied than nations with mighty economies, people are wondering, what are they doing that's different? Now, you can jump far beyond what they're doing in Bhutan by getting onto the spiritual platform. That is what Krishna is teaching in Bhagavad Gita. Yes, it's good to slow down your material affairs and not want so much. But that is not the ultimate solution to your mental peace and satisfaction. Slowing down your material affairs, reducing your material demands, provides a fertile environment for you to achieve real peace. But it won't directly bring about the real peace you're looking for. The real peace and fulfillment and satisfaction you're looking for only comes when you make that pure connection between the spirit soul and the supreme soul, Krishna. Real peace is generated in that connection. Otherwise, you just have a shadow of peace, a shadow of tranquility. And because people are so desperate these days, even a shadow of peace and tranquility looks so monumental for them. So, you might be surprised to know that the study of happiness is now a genuine university discipline. There are, in leading institutions of the world, professors of happiness. And departments of happiness. Because after a century of intense economic endeavor, economic growth, suddenly the truth is starting to dawn on people that we've got mighty economies, our GNP is extraordinary. We don't know what happiness is. So, in the past, you would find that happiness is something talked about only by gurus, philosophers, or therapists. Now, even at universities, it's a legitimate academic discipline. The social conditions of happiness, the study of happiness, because everyone's wondering, what is it? How do you get it? It doesn't seem that you can buy it. Now, what you're going to be seeing more and more is that people are trying to solve the riddle of what to do when the traditional economic goals of growth and consumer activity conflict with the goals of happiness. This is what everyone's afraid of. Yes, we should be happy. Yes, we should be satisfied. But what about the economy? And finally, if there's some conflict, everyone always says, well, go for the economy. You can't give that up. Give up your religion. give up your spiritual practices, but don't give up the economy. Right? This is how people are trained. So more and more, people are starting to understand. I can't make economic growth as the main feature of my life. It has to be supportive. Now, how do they measure people's happiness? It's very difficult for scientists to do that. Especially because many people don't agree on what happiness is. Academics have found 15 definitions of happiness. And they don't agree. Some languages of the world don't have similar conceptions of happiness. You know, they don't have words to express happiness like other languages express. So it's very difficult to figure it out. So they make these surveys by approaching persons, just doing your work week, they come up to you. Do you feel happy? And then they think, but maybe they're not getting an accurate reading because they're just asking you at one random moment of your week. So then they approach you three random times during the same week. Are you happy? And then they take an average. Well, still, there could be some doubt. So then the researchers go and ask your friends and family, do you think he's happy? Not easy to figure out, you know, who is happy. Furthermore, the problem is, happiness can be like an emotional state, different from satisfaction. You might be happy as a momentary mood, but you're not satisfied with your life. So then they have to figure out, what's the difference between happiness and satisfaction? So in order to try to get people to notice the difference so they can have so the researchers can have an accurate study, they ask you, step back from your life a bit. Take a look. Are you satisfied overall with the way your life is? And this way they hope to avoid just getting an emotional response. Yes, I'm happy right now. Because the fear is that many people who may be happy for that moment have overall lives that are unsatisfying. So in this way, this perplexity is there. We're not happy. The world's not happy. What to do? What is the solution? What is real happiness? But no one understands the problem is the uncontrolled mind, just like the genie, the evil genie. Has to have something to do. You know what it's like, the uncontrolled mind, how it can be. When you have some moments when you're not studying, or not working, your mind just vibrates and just shoots all over the universe. And, maybe I'll go see a movie, that'll give my mind relief. Maybe I'll turn on the television. Maybe I'll just go on the street looking at all the shop windows. And then, finally, it comes down to, maybe I should drink. And then, in order to drink, I need some friends. You can't drink alone. So, I have to introduce my friends to drinking. In this way, the whole situation degenerates. Now, happiness is seen in different ways in different cultures. In a place like the U.S., happiness is very individualistic. It's all about achievement, gain, attainment. I've done this, I'm getting this, I'm going to do that, therefore I'm happy. But it's not like that in all countries of the world, especially in Japan, China, Korea, where happiness is more of a collective thing. I have fulfilled my family's expectations. I have fulfilled my social obligations. I have pleased my friends. They respect me. Society respects me. Therefore, I'm happy. It's a completely different vision. Whereas in the USA, in places like that, it's I have done this. I have done that. I have bought this. I have attained this level. I have attained this status. Now, interestingly enough, in the countries that have the individualistic happiness motivation, they also have the highest suicide rates. And in the countries where there's a collective sense of happiness, that I shouldn't strive for myself. No, I should fulfill my family's expectations. I should fulfill my social obligations. I should gain the respect of my friends. That collective sense of happiness is crumbling because they're all those people in those countries are agitated by what they see on television, which is telling them, be individualistically happy. Get for yourself. And then you'll truly be satisfied. Then you look at developing countries. Let's take, for example, South America. There, they found, through research, researchers have found, that the most miserable people are the middle class people, not the poor people. Why is that? Because the middle class is always looking at the wealthy class and seeing, we're so far away from what they have. And so they become miserable. Whereas the poor people look up to the middle class, which is more attainable for them, and so therefore they're not so depressed. But the middle class people, actually, in these developing countries, are the most disturbed. Because they see above them the wealthy class, and it's so far above them, it's out of their reach, therefore they're miserable. But the poor people, they can dream of being middle class, and it's more possible to happen. So that they're actually happier than the middle class. See how crazy all this is? Better to get out of this artificial happiness altogether. To do that, you have to be able to control your mind. This is very important. Now, let's see what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita about happiness. We'll turn to chapter 18. Sukham tadanim trividam shunume varatarshava avyasa ramateya tva duktantam cha nagashati. O best of the Bharatas, now please hear from me about the three kinds of happiness by which the conditioned soul enjoys and by which he sometimes comes to the end of all distress. Purport. A conditioned soul tries to enjoy material happiness again and again. Thus he chews the chewed. You know what that expression means? Chews the chewed? Everyone's familiar with that? Okay. But sometimes, in the course of such enjoyment, he becomes relieved from material entanglement by association with a great soul. In other words, a conditioned soul is always engaged in some type of sense gratification, but when he understands, by good association, that is only a repetition of the same thing, and he is awakened to his real Krishna consciousness, he is sometimes relieved from such repetitive so-called happiness. So this weekend here, we are trying to inspire you to seek relief from repetitive so-called happiness and to recognize that your real career is controlling the mind through the happiness of selfless service to Krishna. The more you seek opportunities to serve Krishna without expecting any reward, the more you'll know what is peace and satisfaction. Selfless service to Krishna is natural because you're a part of Krishna. Krishna is the self of yourself. It is more natural to serve Krishna selflessly than it is to have a family relationship, an ethnic relationship, a national relationship. Krishna is closer to you than all those material relationships which are based on the body. So let's hear about the three types of happiness that you'll find in this world. Bearing in mind, though, that there is spiritual happiness beyond these three types of material happiness that Krishna is talking about. First, Krishna is going to explain happiness in sattva-gun, the mode of goodness. The mode of goodness is material, but it is the highest layer of materialism. Yat tat agre visham eva parināme mṛtopamam tat supam sattvikam proktam atma-buddhi prasadajam. That which in the beginning may be just like poison, but at the end is just like nectar, and which awakens one to self-realization, is said to be happiness in the mode of goodness. Purport. In the pursuit of self-realization, one has to follow many rules and regulations to control the mind and the senses, and to concentrate the mind on the self. All these procedures are very difficult, bitter like poison, but if one is successful in following the regulations and comes to the transcendental position, he begins to drink real nectar and he enjoys life. So, the chanting of Hare Krishna overcomes this phase of the bitter taste of rules and regulations you follow in order to purify yourself. In this day and age, people live very short lives and their minds are very disturbed. It's very difficult for them to take up complicated procedures of mental discipline that were prevalent in other times. Because the atmosphere these days is so disturbed and polluted, Krishna has given us a very direct and clear method for purifying our existence, and that is through chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. You cannot go to the Himalayas and be alone meditating. You can't do that. Your mind is too disturbed. But you can chant Hare Krishna wherever you are. But ordinarily, things wouldn't be so easy as chanting Hare Krishna in the association of others. Ordinarily, the path to self-realization is much more difficult. So many difficult rules and regulations to follow, just like the puffed-up brahmana in the play about the, we saw the cobbler and the brahmana. He had so many rules and regulations he was pretending to follow, and very proud about it. Whereas the cobbler was simply chanting Hare Krishna. So ordinarily it is true that your approach to spiritual happiness is by way of lots of rules and regulations that are difficult in the beginning. They seem to be like poison, but when you finally get through them, you taste the nectar at the end. You're free from the bodily conception of life, which is the root of all distress. But you don't have to worry about that difficulty, because you can chant the Hare Krishna mantra, mantra meditation, and in this way, you are tasting nectar in the beginning and at the end. Instead of tasting something that seems like poison in the beginning and nectar at the end. The chanting of Hare Krishna is sweet through and through, from beginning to end. So those who are intelligent in this most degraded age will take shelter of the holy name of Krishna. But Krishna here in Bhagavad Gita is speaking in general that the beginning of self-realization, enlightenment, can seem to be difficult. controlling your mind and senses, so on and so forth. But later you realize, ah, this is all for my benefit. All right, let's move to happiness in the mode of passion. It's the opposite. Let's hear how Krishna explains that. Vishayendriya sanyoga yatta agrem ratopamam hariname vishameva tatsukam rajasam smritam. That happiness which is derived from the contact of the senses with their objects, and which appears like nectar at first, but poison at the end, is said to be the nature of passion. So think about it. Most of the material happiness that you would be seeking is the mode of passion. It seems nice in the beginning, and then later at the end, you see, it was just distress. It brought about so much problem, so much complexity. But in the beginning, it looked nice. Just like you've come to Australia. It looks nice, yes, this could be the good life. There'll be comfort, there'll be security. It seems that way, but always it turns out bitter. Because the mind is uncontrolled. Because the mind never becomes peaceful by material acquisition. So once again, you can be the wealthiest person in the world, but if your mind is not controlled, it will drive you crazy. Finally, there's the mode of ignorance happiness. And that, unfortunately, is becoming prevalent, even for those coming from India to Australia. The mode of ignorance, so-called happiness, means complete bewilderment from beginning to end. Not even the promise of happiness, the false promise of happiness that the mode of passion gives. The mode of ignorance happiness, so-called happiness, is the happiness of intoxication, just complete delusion. The only kind of happiness that you'll find in material society today is the happiness of passion and ignorance. You won't find any happiness in the mode of goodness. That means you won't find any attempts to follow disciplines for getting to a higher level. That's mode of goodness, happiness. Because the times now are so degraded and people's minds are so agitated, because there's so much mental and physical pollution, Krishna has made things very easy. Krishna comes as Lord Chaitanya, his most merciful appearance, and he teaches you just chant the Hare Krishna mantra, mantra yoga, and you'll have a direct connection to the spiritual happiness beyond happiness in the mode of goodness, passion, or ignorance. Now, this is the advantage of chanting Hare Krishna. Anyone who diligently, daily takes shelter of the Hare Krishna mantra will easily be able to revive their dormant love of Krishna. You'll immediately see the difference. You put it to the test. Those of you who are contemplating taking up the practice of chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, you'll see the results. It's not blind faith. You'll directly be able to see the difference in your life after just a month or so of full chanting. You'll see the results. Just as sure as you can see the sun rising, you'll see the result of the sunshine when the sun comes up. Similarly, you'll see the result that you get from chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. The chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra will inspire you in selfless service to Krishna. And then you have more than mental peace. You have more than the satisfaction of the mind. you have the satisfaction of the soul in connection to the Supreme Soul. That is the greatest wealth. All right, any questions?
It's just that the Krishna consciousness is in itself a paradigm, and we have the Buddhism concept, we have the Bible concept, and there are quite a few sayings that there are, you know, there are people who say that if we do this, you'll reach spiritual level. I mean, which is common in every region or every community or whatever it is. But for a common man, if he's not able to choose, and if there are people from all directions telling you to do this, now that could lead to a lot of confusion. And so, how do you? I mean, it's like, okay, if you do this, you'll achieve this. And I mean, no offenses, but there are other communities which say, okay, if you do this, you'll achieve this. But at the end of the day, the common man is affected. So, where did this all lead to? I mean, it's just the, you know, that's what I understood. So, what do you think, your advice?
Where does it lead to for the common man?
Yes.
Don't be a common man. That is the point of Lord Krishna's instructions in Bhagavad Gita. Don't be a common man. For a common man, there's always confusion and bewilderment. A common man has the hope of, by good fortune, following someone who actually knows what they're doing. The common man can be easily led or misled. So therefore, Krishna consciousness, Lord Krishna's teachings in Bhagavad Gita, are mainly aimed at those who will not be common, who will set the example that others can follow. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, 4th chapter, what does Krishna say? He explains to Arjuna that I spoke this knowledge of Bhagavad Gita to the kings, the saintly kings, and they passed it down from one generation to another. In other words, Bhagavad Gita is meant for the leaders of society. Elsewhere, Lord Krishna explains that what the great person does, the common persons will follow. Yajat acharati shreshta. What the powerful leaders do, that's what the common people will follow. Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga, the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita is actually meant for the uncommon persons, the leaders. If you're a common person, you may, by good fortune, follow the right thing, you may not. Therefore, it's up to the leaders. You want to establish genuine spiritual leaders who can be luminaries to give genuine light to the people. Now, is this your camera? Okay. Right. Let's say it was your camera. Now, there are so many cameras out there. How did you choose this one? I will ask you. How did you choose this camera? Did you just go to a shop and say, I would like to buy a video camera. Which one should I have? Did you do that?
No.
Why not?
I did some basic research first.
Basic research?
On the internet.
On the internet. What did you do?
I went for the technologies present in the... this time, and selected some parameters,
mm-hmm.
and then went down to 2 or 3 models, and then finally to the one you say, could get easily.
You checked all the reviews and all the analysis, right. So, why can't you approach Krishna consciousness in that way? Rather than just saying, the Buddhists say this, the Christians say that, they all have their conceptions, follow our way. It's just like buying a camera. Yeah. JVC says theirs is the best. You know, Panasonic says theirs is the best. Canon says theirs is the best. Sony says theirs is the best. You have to know what you're doing. Don't blame Krishna if you don't know what you're doing. Krishna is giving you all information, all knowledge, so that you'll know how to make a proper choice. If you analyze the situation, you'll see there is no knowledge that comes even close to what Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita. Now, if you're a common man, you can just take that statement at face value and apply it, and your life will benefit. But if you want to be thoughtful about it, then you see. You study what Krishna says, and you see. You'll see. There's nothing like it. There's no more comprehensive spiritual knowledge in the world. If you want to spend the time, you can study the Bible, you can study the Quran. You'll see. There's nothing that compares to Krishna's teachings in Bhagavad Gita in terms of depth and comprehensiveness. Now you mentioned, well, what about Buddhism? Well, Buddhism doesn't deal with God. It just deals with freedom from material suffering. But what happens after that, Buddha never talked about. Christianity has some conception of God. Islam has some conception of God. So then you have to analyze, where will I get the deepest knowledge of God? The full comprehensive understanding. Just like when he purchased his camera. He wanted to see, how do I get the most, the biggest bang for the buck, right? Now, if he had just gone to the shop and, you know, gone somewhere in the center of Melbourne and said, you know, please, Mr. Salesman, tell me what's the best camera. He might have been lucky and got the best thing, and he might not. The salesperson could have just wanted to unload some old models on him. Oh, here's the best. He brings out, you know, last year's model, and I give a special price for you. All the customers say, yeah, this is the best one. That could happen. Or who knows, you might meet an honest salesman, and even though you don't know what you're doing, he tells you which is the best to have. But you decided not to trust fate. You decided not to trust luck. You decided to do research, right? Well, similarly, you can approach Krishna consciousness in that way. You read Bhagavad Gita, you read Srimad Bhagavatam, and then see if there's anything else like it. You won't find anything else like it, but you can try. You've got the time, right? You're not going to school, you're not working, you have plenty of time, right? Yes, you have so much time? Yes.
It's just that things which struck me when I got here, and I was just going through this blind faith back home. Is that when people tell me, oh, you do this, okay, I do this.
Right.
But once I've come here, I've started to know more about myself, not about the spiritual. I mean, because once you know yourself, then only you will know what the spiritual world is. I mean, that's my definition. I mean, there could be something else. But it's just that the situation where what I'm going through. It's not like I'm trying to, okay, I'm going to follow this one, I'm going to follow this one, I'm going to follow this one. It's not like that. It's just that, you know. Otherwise, I wouldn't have come here.
Of course, yes, very good. I was also like this when I finished university. I was in this mood that I have to find the best knowledge. I just don't want to accept something out of blind faith. So maybe when you were young, at home, you just blindly accepted so many traditions, and your parents said, "Do this puja, you'll have success." So you did some puja. worship this demigod, you'll get a good wife, so you worship that demigod. So, and now you come to Australia, and you're starting to question. Okay, that's good. Your questions will only be satisfied when you have the best knowledge. If you approach Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam in that way, then your search will be productive. When I was 21, 22, I was searching for what is the best knowledge available in this world. That was my quest. If you approach Bhagavad Gita in that way, you won't be disappointed. You won't find any more comprehensive, precise spiritual knowledge than what Lord Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita. And then there's the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. You see, if there is God, he wants to know all about this God. Not just, everyone should believe in God. You all nod, yes, yes. If I ask you about your father, you can tell me all about him, yes? If I ask you about God, what can you say? Right. Therefore, you have to find the most comprehensive, deep knowledge of the science of God available in human society. Then you'll be satisfied. And you won't find anything that comes anywhere close to Bhagavad Gita. Because Bhagavad Gita is spoken directly by Krishna, Supreme Personality of Godhead. Furthermore, not only do you read Bhagavad Gita, but apply Krishna's instructions in your life, and you'll see the result. Enter into the bhakti laboratory. See what happens. Make the test. Put it to the test. Krishna says, do like this, do like that, you'll get such and such a result. See what happens. That's truly being scientific. We're saying, you chant the Hare Krishna mantra carefully every day, you will see a major transformation. Now, it doesn't cost you anything. If you're smart, you'll try it and see what happens. I mean, these look like nice people. They don't look like they're deluded. Right? So, you should investigate. What is your field of study?
Accounting.
So accountants are trained to, right? Very precise. So be precise about Krishna consciousness. All right, Krishna says do this. I'm going to do it. I'm going to see what happens. Yes. First, you have to educate yourself, though. I can't do an accounting job. I haven't studied accounting.
Boring.
Why did you choose it if it's boring?
Just happened.
So after choosing, you realized.
It's one of those things that happened.
And you hoped it would lead to the big money, right? And then with the big money, if you did get it, what would you do?
I'll have to see whether I get it first.
With big money, you have big expenses. But your happiness does not improve. In fact, you have more anxiety. You have to keep up the status. No. Don't learn by experience. That's the foolish way to learn. Learn with knowledge. So your questions are very intelligent. What do you think of life here in Australia as you see it?
Just myself.
Mm-hmm. Just yourself?
Yes, I mean, it's, I think, according to me, could be right or wrong, I'm knowing more about myself. I'm like, I know what my potential is for whatever I do, for spiritual, for social, for money, for material, anything, but I know what my potential is, and that is something that I couldn't figure out when I was back home.
Where, back home where?
In India.
Where?
Chennai, Madras.
So in Chennai, you were maybe you felt. Now you realize you were just covered by so many traditions and social expectations and family roles and family obligations. You cannot find yourself. But if I'm coming to Australia,
I think I'm in the process of discovering.
You can just walk down Swanson Street in Melbourne and just free as a bird. You can do anything, and no one would care, right? You can try out so many things, no one will report it to your parents. This is not your real identity. To uncover your real identity, your spiritual identity, you need spiritual techniques. Simply changing from India to Australia does not help you to uncover your real identity. You have to adopt spiritual methods of transformation. So we ask you, please study Bhagavad Gita while you're studying your accounting books. Associate with these wonderful persons here, and the way of bhakti yoga will become more and more clear to you. We're not asking you to believe in anything. We're asking you to walk into the laboratory and start to make the test upon properly educating yourself. That's fair enough. Just like when he got his video camera. He first educated himself, and then he had his vision on a certain model. He bought that model. And if it turned out you didn't like it, you would have brought it back to the shop, right? So you approach Krishna consciousness like that. All right, I'll read Bhagavad Gita, I'll put into action what Krishna says, and I'll see. Fair enough, isn't it? And if you do that, you'll be able to benefit yourself the best way and benefit the whole world. Otherwise, what is your future? You're going to finish accounting school soon?
Just.
And then?
Big money.
Big money. Big money, long hours. Lots of anxiety, yeah. And what is your reward?
Pressure.
And that pressure becomes so intense, you don't know how to get rid of it. And then gradually you have to do what the Australians do to get rid of stress. Oh, you say no, no, no. You'll see. If you go that route, you'll see. They'll tell you, why are you going through all this stress and pressure, which is normal, without taking the appropriate relief? You're thinking too much about things. All you have to do is come with us to the pub. All your problems will disappear. Ah, you're saying no, no, no. When the pressure becomes so intense. You become like who you associate with. You have to associate with someone. So here we're giving you the best persons to associate. These swan-like persons here. Take advantage. Anything else?
Just to write something there, just to set the ball rolling, we could start reading, searching for Vedic India, just to get a comparative study of all the existing systems.
Oh, you like that book?
Yeah.
I put a lot of work into it.
Yes. I was wondering how many years of effort you put in that.
Two. But some of the things, some of the themes I had been thinking about for 20 years. I wrote that book to reduce the pride of materialists who think they know everything. In other words, in that book I'm showing that even from the material point of view, materialists don't know what's going on. There's so much they don't understand. Let's speak up from the spiritual point of view. My goal was that when you finish reading Searching for Vedic India, then you'll easily be able to approach Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. You won't be thinking anymore, oh, it's mythology, it's folklore. Instead, you'll start to think that Western knowledge and science is mythology and folklore. So it made you think, didn't it?
Yes.
Mm.
I was suspecting it.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Now we talk about karma. When we have to do a karma, there are so many prospects, like taking dharma into account. Like, if I have to do a karma to make a dharma, like as a mother, as a daughter-in-law, which position do I have to take to accomplish a karma?
What do you mean by a karma?
A karma, like I have come here, my son is back home again. I have come here to accomplish the dreams of my father-in-law. In one way, I'm doing the dharma as being a daughter-in-law.
He wanted you to come here.
Yes.
You please thank him for me. So he's a wonderful father-in-law. That he wanted you to come here.
But on the other hand, I feel that my son is alone there. I have not been a good mother to him.
Mm. How old is your son?
He's 5.5 years old.
Who's taking care of him now?
My in-laws are taking care of him.
And you are gone for how long? 10 years?
It's been more than 2 years now.
Ah. And he's in India?
Yeah.
Mm. Why are you here in Australia?
To study and to get the residence to accomplish the dream of my father-in-law.
Ah. Oh, I misunderstood you. I thought you meant your father wanted you to come here when you said now. Oh, that's why I said thank you. I wanted you to come here. But you meant he wanted you to come to Australia.
Okay, he's not much
into devotion at all. Oh, well, don't thank him. How can he send his dear daughter to such a place? No, it is not good. It's not good to be separated from your child for such a long time. It's bad for the child's development, even material, let's speak of spiritual. It's not good. And this is an example of problems. Why should a mother go up to Australia, leave her family and child in pursuit of a material dream? So, no.
What should be my position in this time, like, it's a conflict, being a mother and a daughter-in-law?
Living in this material world is always a conflict. You get over that conflict by the practice of bhakti yoga. You study Krishna's words and apply them in your life. Arjuna also had a conflict, you know, in Bhagavad Gita. He had a big problem. He had to fight a battle against former friends and against relatives. And Krishna solved that problem. And Krishna can certainly solve your problem. I know what you mean. It doesn't seem like there's a material solution. So you take the spiritual solution. I'm sorry that your father-in-law sent you here. to Australia, away from your child, away from your family. And now you are here. You go for the best thing. You go for the Krishna consciousness. And then you practice that. And when you go home, you try to India, you try to get your family to practice Krishna consciousness. That's the best thing. You make advancement in Krishna consciousness and then teach it to your son. And that will make up for your being away. Take advantage of your presence here in Australia to learn how to give your son the best gift. Otherwise, I agree, it is a useless waste of time. And it is bad for your family's development. Why a mother comes all the way from India to Australia in search of the big money, leaving her child, leaving family? You think this is going on, you see? What kind of society does this? This is what's happening these days. Husband is here too? Oh, he's here. And child is in India. Of course, the in-laws, I'm sure they're taking nice care of the child, but still, the child should be with the husband. The child should be with the father and mother. But there are so many social problems these days. The best, whatever circumstances you're in, increase your Krishna consciousness. That's the best thing. Your husband is here at this?
No.
No. Why did he come?
He's working.
Okay, next time you bring him, okay? He's interested in Krishna consciousness?
Yes.
Very good. All right. So that's the way to make a win out of the whole situation. You and your husband endeavor in Krishna consciousness, and then as your heart becomes purified, as your mind becomes purified, you'll be able to make the proper decision for the future of your family. Okay? Anything else?
What are the guidelines for disseminating Krishna consciousness to your children? A framework.
The guidelines for disseminating Krishna consciousness to your children are that you have to walk your talk. You can't tell your children, do this, if you're not doing it. You have to give them the right example.
Become a president? Become a president?
Yes. You must set the proper example for your children. Not that, for example, the father is smoking cigarettes and then telling the children, don't smoke, it's very bad for you. I've seen this. I'm smoking because it's my habit since a young boy. I know it's bad, but I cannot stop. I've been doing it for 40 years. But you don't. If I ever see you with a cigarette. You can't be like that. Children are not fooled in that way. Set a devotional example in your family, and then you are properly discharging your family responsibilities. Very good question. Anything else? All right. Once again, it's a great pleasure to talk to you all, and I hope I've given you some things to think about. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.